Having a good time? Enjoying your life after the take-home test? You are? Rather wouldn't want to have another one and just do it all over again? No? Regina, you would? Come on. You wouldn't? Charles, would you? Well, you know. What do you know? What do you know? Okay. There's a lot of handouts today. And the reason why there's a lot of handouts is that there's a lot of laws. And I've been spending as much time as I possibly can updating as many laws as I could possibly find, as you will see, that deal with genetics. And you have a selected number of handouts. You probably have about 10% of the ones that I've actually printed out in order to talk to you and chat to you today about DNA and the law. And then you have a lecture handout, but the lecture handout's actually in two parts because it was so large, because I incorporated so many laws and stuff in here. And the other part will be coming soon, so we'll have it in about 40 minutes. And after that, we'll take a break and we'll give it to you, depending upon where I'm at. So keep that in mind. So you have handouts on eugenics, history, and issues that we'll talk about. You have handouts on California and federal laws that deal with genes and other kinds of things. A lot of that is also in the handout packet, not duplicated. And you have discussion and concept question handouts, which will be for tomorrow's discussion. So you have all of that. The HC70AL meeting has been changed because many people have had a conflict. So it's going to be now on Friday afternoon of this week at 3 p.m. So please mark that down, so that all of you will be there. It's a very important meeting because that's where we'll be organizing everything for next quarter and telling you exactly what you'll be doing. So please remember Friday, March 10th, this Friday, 3 p.m. In my hallway in the conference room, which most of you are familiar with, and we'll have a meeting. It shouldn't go more than 30 minutes, 45 minutes at the most. And we'll be introducing you to everyone who's going to be involved in that marvelous experience for next quarter. Discussion tomorrow is very important and very timely. Timely because you're all aware of the anthrax attacks which have been on the country, on the Senate, on post offices in Florida, and a variety of other places. And you also should be aware that the people who perpetrated those attacks have never been found, never been caught. And so whoever was doing this is still out there and lurking, and you'll be reading about why anthrax is really a potent, potent, potent bioweapon. What you won't be reading about, unfortunately, because we don't have time, is the whole history of anthrax in biowarfare. And in fact, the history of anthrax, and I'm just going to give you a little bit here. The history of anthrax goes back to the Cold War and to the early 1950s. And you're probably all going to be surprised that under the Freedom of Information Act, which was presumably done to put things into the public domain and not have them as federal secrets, all of the war plan, all of the biological and chemical war plans of the United States of America, which were completely top secret, including blueprints to make weapons to put on airplanes and to aerosolize anthrax, have all been made public, and you can find all of them on the internet because they've all been released under the Freedom of Information Act before 9/11. Perhaps if it was after 9/11, that wouldn't have happened. But be aware of the fact that there's a long history of chemical and biological warfare research in the United States and in other countries. And this was primarily during the Cold War. And anthrax was one of the subjects of the most intense research efforts in the United States and in the former Soviet Union. And in fact, in the former Soviet Union, there's a notorious case in the 70s of release of anthrax in one of their bioweapons labs that killed hundreds of people and was completely kept secret until the downfall of the Soviet Union. And again, you'll be talking tomorrow about how one can identify those strains. And in fact, it wasn't until DNA testing that people could really understand the origins of this particular disease, of this particular weapon and this disease. So anthrax is a scary, 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 scary disease. And it's a really powerful bioweapon because it can be aerosolized and it can be taken on a plane and it can be used to cover literally hundreds and hundreds of square miles. And if you inhale this stuff, and if you don't have the only antibiotic which can kill it, Cipro, because all the other ones don't work, you're dead. It's as simple as that. And the reason why it's used as a bioweapon is because, think about this, and Mike's going to talk about this tomorrow, and I'm not trying to upstage him, but if you start using Ebola and smallpox and flu for bioweapons, it can infect your own population. But anthrax can't, because you're taking it someplace else. And so the purpose of me having you read this article is you'll understand how it infects humans and how it is a killer bacteria and how one could potentially combat it. Then the second article for discussion tomorrow is a lot of fun. And it's something also which is very important because it's in the news. It deals with flu, the flu virus, and why the flu virus is such a potent virus. So I chose this for you to read primarily because it's something that has killed millions and millions of people. But what you're going to read about how genetic engineering and DNA sequencing was used to take tissues out of the permafrost from dead bodies that were killed in the 1918 flu pandemic, which killed 20 million people worldwide. And just recently, within the last 5 years, people went into the permafrost, got tissues that were infected from deceased individuals, and using genetic engineering, revitalized the virus by basically synthesizing it and sequencing its genome and finding out exactly why it was such a potent pathogen. It came and it went, as you'll read, very instantaneously. But again, that raises issues of bioterrorism, and all of those studies that were done with that flu were done under very, very high containment, maximum containment, in order to prevent this thing from getting out, although most of us have immunity to that. It's the bird flu, which, of course, has been in the news. And then it's how can biotechnology be used to combat terror? And this is extremely important and the subject of a tremendous amount of research. And I should also add that research in microbiology was kind of languishing for a while until the anthrax attacks. And now it's really flourishing in this era of genomics because, as you know from your take-home tests, you can do a lot with DNA to learn about what these things are all about and to combat them. Take these articles seriously. Within the last 5 years, people have been killed with at least one of these bacteria being used as a bioweapon. This is not something which is in our imagination. This is something that's very real. And in fact, only last week, we're at the University of Texas, they thought that someone had left anthrax or ricin or some other potent toxin. It wasn't the case. It was ricin, which is another potent toxin. But the point here is that this is serious, serious, serious business to all of us in this era where someone could potentially grow this bacteria in a lab which is no more sophisticated than what you have in junior high school or in their house or in their garage and cause a tremendous amount of damage. You'll have a quiz this week. It'll cover your discussions from cancer and bioweapons, so you'll have a double. Your assignments, your take-home test, your quizzes, your double helix essay, all of that will be given back to you today after class. So you'll have everything coming back to you. The take-home exam, thanks to Tomo and Brandon and Gloria and Mike and Jessica and all of us, has been completely graded and will be returned to you in record time. It's actually not record time because I have a policy of always getting an exam back the class after the exam comes in or is given, and so I'll maintain that record, and I'll talk more about that towards the end of class. What about this thing called regrading? Let me tell you what my policy is. So here's how it works. There's always errors in grading. I mean, it always happens when you grade all kinds of exams, particularly ones like this. So if there's an error, if there's an error in adding up your score, and trust me, I understand how important grades are to you. It's your cash for the future. So I'm very sensitive to that. So if there's just some, you know, clerical error or some other kind of error, you know, hand it back in to me. The TAs, Mike and Gloria, cannot look at your exam or regrade it or anything. It's my responsibility. And so hand it to me with a note saying that, you know, you added the points wrong and we'll fix it. Or if you think that something was not graded fairly or that we misinterpreted your answer, then please type it up, what you think your answer was. Just type it out and explain why perhaps it should be relooked at, and hand in your exam and your typed explanation to me. And here's how the policy works. When you hand that in, I will personally grade your entire exam myself, not just that question. So I'm going to regrade the entire exam. Because in my experience, it generally works out that sometimes things, if it's not a mistake or something which has completely been mistaken, we tend to give the benefit of the doubt. And so in those things where perhaps the answer wasn't as clear as you wanted, we may not have given the benefit of the doubt, but in another question, we did give the benefit of the doubt. It kind of works both ways. So I look and I'll re-examine the whole exam from beginning to end. And then you'll make an appointment with me, and those questions which you think you should answer or have answered, you will discuss them with me orally. In other words, you'll answer the question for me. And if you do that, like you did on the oral exam where you did a magnificent job, and then I know that you understand it, which I think you all do, then I'll generally give all the points. But that's what the policy is. And I can explain some other time why this is the policy, but the policy is such that I want you to learn this material. So that's what it is. And it'd be the same with the double helix essay. So when you, if you think that perhaps something was misunderstood or not graded fairly or whatever, which I can appreciate and I totally understand, then just write it up, hand it back into me, and make an appointment with me, and we'll come in and we'll discuss it, and you'll explain to me exactly what you meant. I may ask you a few questions, but that's basically how it works. I don't think any of you are going to have a problem with any of that, but we'll talk about that later. Dinner tonight is going to be a little bit, I'm going actually back to my traditional dinners in Westwood after class. The dinner tonight, for those of you that RSVP'd, will be at 9 p.m. at Napa Valley Grill. The reason for the time is because I have several things that have to be done before now and 9 p.m., and it's also a better time because one can talk because there's no one there anymore. And so it's generally much better, and that's traditionally when I used to have all of my dinners. So for those of you, Charles and Nico and Patricia and Victoria and Jessica, I think one of you had not RSVP'd. Jessica over here, Jessica Luke, will give you a map to where Napa Valley Grill is, and there may be an extra spot for one more student. So if you're dying to go to dinner tonight, either you want to do it again or you haven't done it, you can't do it next week, please see Jessica, and that can be arranged. Okay? Food's better at the Napa Valley Grill than the Faculty Center anyways. Next week we'll go back. I'm not sure what we're going to do. This week is DNA and the Law, as I said, human genome and genetic diversity. Next week is Greg Stock on Tuesday. I'll say a little bit more about Greg on Thursday, but if you go into Google and you put up his name, you're going to get about 5 million hits back. I mean, this guy is an icon. And I will say that he generally gets between $40,000 and $75,000 per lecture. But for you guys, he's doing it for free. And so, because he's a great guy and he's a reasonably good friend of mine, but he's very, very provocative. And that's why I'm using him for the last guest lecture. And you're going to like him a lot because he has a lot to say, and he's a real, real thinker, an original thinker. And that's part of his business. And I'll say more about him on Thursday. A week from Thursday, you have the final oral exam and class project. I think Mike and Gloria have talked to you a little bit about this project. Let me just say something about the final oral exam. You guys did a magnificent job on Thursday, as I told you. And so the format of the final oral exam will be almost the same, but not quite. It's always little surprises, always things that are new. So because it's only a week off, I'm just going to give you a head start. The oral exam will have one question from the quizzes, but you won't know what that question is in advance. In other words, when you come in to the oral exam, you'll pick one of those questions. So you've had an X number of quizzes. Whoever draws the quiz question, whatever group draws that, will go, you know, quiz 1 through 8. If you pick quiz 8, that's the one you answer. There'll also be a question from the take-home test. So it'll be another question from the take-home test. And again, you won't know what it is until you pick it out of the little bag. Okay, and that can be anyone, the bonuses, anything, and presumably, you know, you've already gone over that and you know it. Then there'll be 5 new questions. And these will be brand new, and those questions will be given to you on Thursday. And you can have those for a week and prepare them and get together with groups and learn them and all of that stuff. But there'll be, when I say brand new, that won't mean there'll be something you haven't seen before. Of course, it's going to be on material you've seen in the class or discussion or the speaker or someplace. The difference between this exam and what you saw last week, which I did as a sort of a warm-up, is that you're involved in 2 questions, and you're graded on 2 questions on this exam. You'll be split into a challenge group and an answer group. And the way this works is that the answer group picks a question and answers the question and has approximately 7 to 8 minutes in sort of the same format that you saw already. But then the challenge group will challenge the answer group on their answer first, and then anything involved in the class related to that particular answer or anything else. And then after the challenge group is over, you will then be challenged by Mike and Gloria, and finally by myself. That's how it works. And it's a lot of fun, as you'll see. And in this case, you'll be graded individually. So you all have an individual grade based on what you did in terms of how you performed, and you all have a group grade. It's mostly group, probably 80%, 75%, but it's also 20 to 25% individual. Okay, and that's that. I'll talk more about this on Thursday. It's a fun experience, as you will see, and you're prepared for it because you did so well last time, and it generally goes great. Everyone has a lot of fun, but you got to be on your toes on this one, because sometimes the challenges go to other people, as you saw last week, than people in the group. And I may open it to the whole class, and I may ask questions, or Mike and Gloria may ask questions, or anyone in the class can ask a question about anything in the entire class. You know, structure of DNA, what's adenine, you know, what are plasmids, what are vectors, all of that stuff enters into the play at some point. And again, it's a group experience, and you'll see how that works. There's nothing to be worried about because you did fantastically last week. I think that's about it. Let me make sure. Yeah, that's about it. Are there any questions that you might have on anything? I'll save the best for last. Any questions? Yeah, Becca.
The 5 new questions for the final, are those going to be turned in like the midterm, or is it just the oral
No,
exam?
No turning in anything. Okay. This is just oral exam. Nothing written, nothing to prepare, nothing to hand in. It's all completely oral exam. I'm only giving you the questions because that's part of my style here. I don't want you to come into anything that you haven't seen before and have a chance to prepare. Philosophy is learning. That's the bottom line, learning. And what you see is what you get. No tricks, no nothing. as you know. Charles, you happy about that?
Yes and no.
Why no? Why no?
I don't like tests.
Yeah, but you tested your whole life, unfortunately. Nothing like it either. I got a big test today just talking to you with about 3 hours of sleep at the most. And so, you know, it's just part of the whole thing.
Right.
You know, and since all of you are doing so well, I don't think any of you have to worry about anything. Yes, Daisy.
So our final exam will will be not this Friday, but three Fridays from now.
No.
Next Friday?
A week from Thursday, a week from this coming Thursday, at approximately 6 p.m. in the evening, you're done with this class. Isn't that great? With lots of surprises. Are there any other questions? Surprises that will go unspoken. Jason, you have any questions? Sure? You're happy? Nervous? Good. Nico? Even though I know you BS'd me last week because you couldn't have failed not to learn something on exam, you did reasonably well, so if you didn't learn anything, I'd be awfully surprised how you got such a high score.
I got a high score? that was a little joke, Goldberg. My question was...
Interested to know how many of you had the same answers, including spelling errors, but we can talk about that offline. Go ahead.
Okay. I missed one lecture, and I have not yet watched it on the online one, but so I'm wondering if maybe that was the lecture. I don't know, but we haven't covered the race as in regards to genetics
coming up.
Yet.
It's coming up.
Okay.
Any other questions? You're smarter than you think. Melissa, I responded to your email. Okay. Sam, you happy?
Yep.
Cincinnati Bengals?
Chicago Bears.
Chicago Bears. Oh, my God. George Blanda. Oh, my God. Chicago Bears. Chicago Bears. How about the Cleveland Browns? No? Okay. Let me talk about something which is a lot of fun, and which is, again, a moving target, a big moving target. And I don't have all the answers. I don't propose to have all the answers. I'm not going to give you all the answers. Because it's too big to give you all the answers, but I'll give you a little bit of a skeleton here. And I think you're going to be surprised about a lot of stuff. So what I'm going to talk about is DNA and the law. I'm going to talk about DNA. We're going to go over some science. And I'm going to talk about some legal issues dealing with DNA and the law. And primarily what we're dealing with in DNA and the law is obviously DNA testing and how it's used and what protections you might have and what kind of perhaps negative impact it can have if it's not used in the proper way. And clearly with having the Human Genome Project completely done, just because something of a really more serious nature. This book called Genetics, Ethics, Law, and Policy is the best book you could ever have for all of these issues. It's a law book. It's written by three law professors that write extensively on genetics and the law, both very, very prominent in their field. Lori Andrews and Mark Rothstein are just remarkable individuals that have thought about these issues perhaps more than anybody that I've ever talked to or read about. And so if any of you want to read more about this stuff, get a hold of any of their papers or that book or whatever and be able to read it, because I think it's going to say an awful lot. Now, What is genetic information used for? And I think you all know this. And I think we've talked about this the entire quarter. It's obviously used in medicine. It's obviously used for screening for primarily disease genes. It's used to identify individuals that are carriers. It's used to help people with respect to whether they should have a child or not. It's used to determine whether someone should carry pregnancy to term. It's used to verify particular kinds of symptoms that might manifest themselves as a genetic disease, and you want to know whether it's really a genetic disease. It's used in all aspects that are up there, but there'll be new aspects based on the Human Genome Project where one can assay literally any gene in the human genome for which some known function occurs, or, as you will see in a few minutes, which you already know, any groups of genes. And so it's going to be possible to do a lot more using genomics, using the DNA sequence, using chips that we've ever been able to do before. So it's used in terms of helping medical diagnosis and, if presumably, susceptibility to diseases, susceptibility to drugs, all kinds of things, so that if one is found to have a certain set of alleles or a certain set of alleles that predispose them some way, that perhaps one can do something about it in terms of treating or whatever. But it's also used, as you know, in identification. It's used in identification, as you'll see hopefully on Thursday, of human origins, where we've come from, which has many, many, many surprises. It's used in forensic identification. It's used in the law in terms of crime, as you know, from your play. It's used in all kinds of parentage, you know, who's the father, who's the mother, adoptions, all kinds of different issues where DNA identification is used. And so in many respects, we're immersed, as I said almost 10 weeks ago, in this era of DNA testing and DNA. And you may remember that I started this class with that figure on the board. We're immersed in this. Everyone is aware of DNA fingerprints. Everyone is aware of DNA testing. Everyone is aware of the power of things can be used with this kind of technology. So it can be used, you know, you can send this in and find out what your genealogy is. You can send this to a test to find out, you know, parentage. You can find out whatever you want to find out, or you can use it, you know, on infant testing, adult testing, or whatever. It's a very, very powerful technology, as you know, and it's virtually 100% accurate. It's not completely accurate, no test is, but it's extremely accurate and very powerful. And in such a case, it's really been a revolution in the law to be able to think about the uses of this technology or the misuses of this technology and try and get protections for individuals, at least in the United States, based on what we'll talk about in a few minutes of history. So before I go into the legal aspects, I think it's important to review the science of DNA testing, because you've talked about it quite a bit in this class, but some of the things you haven't talked about. And what I want to do is keep you current in terms of how these things are carried out and contrast them to the things that you're familiar with. Just leave it, Jessica. Don't even worry about them right now. So what I want to do is go over a little bit of science to help you understand the power of this technology. Some of this is going to be review, but some of it's going to be absolutely, completely new to you. So let me just talk in two parts, because this is the gist of it. And remember, all the laws that deal with DNA and genetics deal with these tests. And that's why I'm going over them. In other words, that's the main concern: DNA screening, DNA testing, DNA in forensics, DNA in the law, identifying individuals, identifying your genotypes, finding out what disease genes you might have or might carry or whatever. And it all comes down to two issues. One, how do you use these tests in medicine? That's number one. And two, how do you use these tests in forensics for just identification, either for crime reasons or for any other reason? And in some respects, these tests are slightly different. So let me start on the medical aspects and just review some of the things we've talked about. It's a lot of human disease genes, as you know. We've talked about this many times. I may go over it a little bit on Thursday. I'm not sure how far I'll go. But there's, 35,000 genes in the human genome, and probably only 5,000 of them have been correlated with a known human disease. Okay, that's important. Even though there's 35,000 genes, only a fraction of them have been correlated with a very specific phenotype, shown to have some genetic manifestation that's inherited. And remember I said a long time ago that those are called, inborn errors of metabolism, first derived by Girard, and I'm going to come back to Girard in a few minutes. But here's just a list, and it's not really an ultimate list, but if you want the whole list of human disease genes known to date, go into this thing called OMIM. Go on the web, go into OMIM, and you'll be able to get every single solitary disease gene that's been associated with everything up to today, because it's kept pretty much up to date through a Johns Hopkins site. And I was going to go over it, but I decided not to. But the point is we have these disease genes. And as you know, and as I'm going to come back to, this was the subject of much investigation at the turn of the 20th century. And as you know, people started thinking that these disease genes followed Mendelian rules. And people started thinking, hey, maybe we can do something to be able to eliminate them from human populations. And so one of the first disease genes that was discovered, and we've talked about this, was phenylketonuria. And it was actually the subject of the first newborn baby test in the 1960s. But the disease was identified as a genetic disease by Girard in the teens, that is 1915, 1920, somewhere in that area. So it's one of the first genetic diseases, one of the first diseases that was associated with a genetic defect. And what this thing called phenylketonuria is that all of your protein that you make is eventually degraded. And as those proteins are degraded, because they're made, degraded, made, degraded, made, degraded, made, degraded, as they're degraded, the peptide bonds are degraded, the amino acids are released, they're either reused again, or those amino acids are degraded down to carbons and hydrogens and nitrogens, and you pee them out, basically. And so what phenylketonuria is a defect in protein degradation. It's a defect in the degradation of protein, specifically of the amino acid phenylalanine. And when an individual lacks a very specific enzyme, right here called phenylalanine hydroxylase, or has a mutation in that particular gene, this step, which goes from the degradation of phenylalanine down to eventually nitrogen, carbons, and oxygens, is blocked, and you get toxic levels of phenylalanine building up in the brain, and toxic levels of phenylalanine building up in the brain leads to very severe mental retardation. And it was discovered very early on by Robert Guthrie in the 60s, late 50s, that if you can identify individuals with PKU as they're born, right out of the womb, and you can restrict the diet so that you eliminate phenylalanine completely from the diet, these infants can get over a hump and be able to have a completely normal and healthy life. And once their brain has formed perfectly, then they can eat phenylalanine and they have absolutely no problems. And this first screening test for an inborn error of metabolism was known as the Guthrie test. And it's not a DNA-based test, quite the opposite. You take a little bit of blood from the heel of the baby and you put it on these little cardboard papers. It's called a blood collection card. And then what you do is you see whether or not bacteria, which have a defect in a gene, in a pathway required to synthesize phenylalanine, so you have mutant bacteria that don't have the ability to synthesize phenylalanine, You see whether there's a high level of phenylalanine in the blood of the baby and whether that blood can be used by the bacteria to take up phenylalanine and grow. And so the test is a bacterial test, basically. You're taking the blood from the newborn baby, you're adding it to the bacteria, which needs phenylalanine to grow and to be alive. And if the bacteria grow on plates, then you know that the baby has phenylketonuria. If the bacteria don't grow, it's a very simple plus-minus test. If the bacteria don't grow, then you know the baby's normal. And so you're looking for a high concentration of this amino acid in the blood, phenylalanine, and you're looking for this high level of phenylalanine to be able to be added to a bacteria, which is a mutant bacteria, which does not have the ability to make phenylalanine, so that when you supply it phenylalanine, it can grow. And so growth means the baby has PKU. Lack of growth means that it's a normal baby. And that was the subject of the first screening program that we'll talk about in a few minutes, but not right now. So it's a non-DNA-based test. And there's a lot of non-DNA-based tests. For example, sickle cell anemia. The first screening test for sickle cell anemia was simply looking under the microscope at the sickling of the blood. Because under low oxygen conditions, instead of the blood looking like this with a nucleus, it has a sickling structure basically like that. And so that's, again, a non-DNA-based genetic test for a genetic disease. Other tests for genetic diseases were simply enzyme tests, looking for the presence or the absence of a specific enzyme which carries out a specific metabolic reaction. What I'm saying is that there's been many screening assays developed for defective genes in humans that are not DNA-based, but yet indirectly measure whether the gene is defective or not defective. And again, sickling would mean there's a defective globin gene, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. A defective enzyme or loss of an enzyme would mean that enzyme is absent, and you can do these tests in the absence of DNA, but they're cumbersome, time-consuming, expensive, difficult, and, for example, they're limited because it's not known what some of these enzymes are, or you don't have an assay for these enzymes. It's limited because not everything is in the blood and sickles, and so they're not as powerful and they're very limited, but these were the first tests that were assayed. So you can have these infant tests, DNA-based and non-DNA-based, and of course you can have adult testing in child testing by basically looking in the blood, white blood cells. Or you can do the cheek assay, but you get a little bit more DNA when you use the blood. So what I'm saying here is that newborn screening approaches and screening for genetic diseases in adults and in children preceded the use of DNA. Preceded the use of DNA because all you have to have is a marker. And if you have a marker, you can test for whether that marker is there or not there. Sickling is a marker for sickle cell anemia. Lack of a particular enzyme is a marker for a metabolic disease that requires a specific enzyme. And I could go on and give you more examples. And these, both with infants and with newborns and with adults and with children, were the precursors to the DNA screening methods. And in fact, there were a lot of screening programs that occurred in the pre-DNA, in the pre-gene era. So the question really becomes, how are these DNA tests then carried out today? Why are they so powerful? And how will they get even more powerful than they are? So some of them you're familiar with, but a few of them you're not. This is the old-fashioned way. So the first thing is, in order to assay for the presence of a specific allele, you have to use genetic engineering to clone the gene because you have to be able to know what gene you're dealing with, and that's obvious. So you can't do these things in a vacuum. So that means the first step in all of this stuff is a clone of the gene or a clone of the copy of the messenger RNA or a cDNA. If you want to assay for the sickle cell disease using DNA assays, you have to have a clone of the globin gene, which is affected by the mutation which causes sickle cell anemia. If you want to assay using DNA-based assays for cystic fibrosis, you have to have a clone of either the cystic fibrosis gene or you have to have a clone of the copy of the messenger RNA in order to do that. So you have to have, and that begins with all of the things that you've learned in this class about cloning either genes or cloning messenger RNAs. That's the first step. But the old-fashioned way, the DNA blot or the Southern blot method, is relatively crude and ancient by today's standards. And the disadvantages of it are twofold. The first disadvantage is you need a lot of DNA, a lot. We're talking about tens of micrograms. And that means you need a lot of blood. And that means that that eliminates a lot of possible tests. For example, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, PGD, you can't use this procedure with because you can't get enough DNA. And so the old procedure required a lot of DNA. And secondly, it required a restriction enzyme polymorphism. It required a loss of a restriction site because the marker was a difference in the size of a DNA band. And you're all familiar with this. You know, one size DNA band for one allele, another size DNA band or multiple bands for the other allele. And it was very cumbersome because it required, again, a lot of DNA, restriction enzymes. It required a cumbersome procedure, which those of you that are taking the lab next quarter will probably learn, involving gels and radioactive probes, time-consuming, expensive, and that one of these assays probably takes at least a week to do. Not very, very suitable to high levels of screening in large populations, cheaply, simply. It's accurate, but it was tough. And so you know what the assay is. I don't really have to go over it, but in this case, we have sickle cell anemia, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this. What you have is a mutation at a very specific site in the beta globin gene. Sickle cell anemia is due to a defect in a globin gene. The globin gene makes globin, which is the oxygen carrier protein of your blood. There's a very specific mutation. That very specific mutation eliminates a restriction site or puts one in. And what you have is a difference in a DNA band. And what you have on a DNA blot is a polymorphism that you can see right over here. The sickle allele is bigger than the wild-type allele. And so by using this polymorphism, you can just see homozygote, heterozygote, and you can do a very nice DNA screening assay. But it's cumbersome. And I'll come back to that in a minute. A manifestation of that assay, which has made it a little bit simpler and a little faster, but it still has some of the cumbersome attributes, is to incorporate the polymerase chain reaction. So what I'm saying is in DNA screening assays that are done today, no one does a Southern blot. All the DNA gel blot technology that you learned about is not used anymore in DNA screening assays, but it's used historically, and conceptually, everything derives from that. So the next manifestation is the polymerase chain reaction. And the polymerase chain reaction then allows you to amplify directly from the genomic DNA of healthy and diseased individuals specific genes by the amplification reaction. But what you have to know in this particular assay is the sequence of the gene. So therefore, the gene had to be cloned. Because as you recall from the polymerase chain reaction, you have to have very specific primers. Remember, it's a DNA replication process, but it's a DNA replication process inside a test tube, and you can't do it without having these primers that start the whole chain reaction going. And in order to get the sequence of those primers, you have to know the sequence of the gene. But the point here is that you can amplify up any gene that you want directly from a tiny amount of DNA. So what's the advantage of adding the polymerase chain reaction into the mix for DNA screening? The advantage is you need almost no DNA. You can start with only a few molecules, as you know. So now you can adapt this procedure to a single cell, like a single embryonic cell from an egg-celled pre-implantation embryo. And so now pre-implantation genetic diagnosis becomes a reality. Before PCR, it was not a reality. After PCR, it does become a reality. But conceptually, this type of PCR assay is very similar to what I just showed you, because what you're doing is amplifying a gene. There it is, both the wild-type allele and, let's say, this other allele, or allele 1 or allele 2, doesn't matter which allele it is. And if there's a polymorphism, you can then use a restriction enzyme on the amplified DNA. So what am I saying? What I'm saying is you first isolate some DNA from a single cell or more. You amplify the genes in question. If there's a polymorphism between those alleles that can be detected with a restriction enzyme, you digest the amplified DNA with the restriction enzyme, and then you fractionate by size on a gel. And if you do that, you can now start scoring for the different genotypes by just looking at the size. There's one size, there's another size, there's another two of the DNA bands, and you can figure out exactly what the genotype is. Is that clear, Sam? Kyle, is that clear? It's exactly the same as a southern blot, except there's no southern blot. But you're using a restriction enzyme site as your marker for your polymorphism. That's the key. But there's no radioactive probe. There's no autoradiography. There's no blotting. You're just amplifying the DNA direct from the genome. Then you're digesting with the DNA, fractionating on a gel, and you're illuminating the gel with this dye, ethidium bromide, which fluoresces as it binds to the double helix, and you can see it, and there it is. Very, very nicely done. So there's one kind of homozygote, another kind of homozygote, and there's the heterozygote, and you can do it. So the advantage is a tiny amount of DNA. Well, that's used sometimes, but it's not used very much. And the reason why it's not used very much is you have to have that gel system. And that gel system takes time. And if you want something that can be used in medicine or for DNA screening, you need something that's rapid, you need something that's cheaper, you need something you can do faster, and also you need something that can be done in a hospital clinic. I mean, this takes a lot of expertise even to do this. So it's too cumbersome. And so now we're getting to what is actually being done today to assay specific disease alleles, or any difference in alleles for that matter. And this is something that you've never heard of before. It's called ASO technique. ASO. ASO. For those three letters. And this is very powerful, very fast, very cheap, and very accurate. And it doesn't require any restriction enzymes, doesn't require any probe, doesn't require any blotting, doesn't require anything, as you will see, except a very simple hybridization reaction, which can be done, and you can get a colorimetric assay, and you can get one very quickly. So if you look at this, which is the analysis of the sickle cell trait, what you can get is something that is exactly like this, where you would know that this is normal. This is carrier, and that's diseased, and that's just a little piece of filter paper, and it's a little colorimetric assay where it would be blue, 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 white, white, and you know within 10 minutes exactly what the genotype of the individuals are, and you can do this for $5 to $10. It is cheap, or even cheaper. And so this is the method of choice almost. There's one more sophisticated one we'll talk about when we talk about the crime, but this is the method of choice for obvious reasons. No restriction enzymes, no restriction fragment length polymorphism, no gel, no radioactive probe, no autoradiography, very simple, all geared to clinical assays in hospitals where technicians can carry out these assays very rapidly, very accurately, very simply, and you get a plus-minus result. No interpretations, and very straightforward. Anton, you have a question? Okay. So what does this ASO mean? It's a very fancy name. A is for allele. S is for specific. O is for oligonucleotide. What is an oligonucleotide? It's just a short nucleic acid. Oligonucleotide is a short nucleic acid of a particular sequence. So it's called ASO, allele-specific oligonucleotide. And in fact, this is the precursor to chips, because the principle of the way chips work, at least DNA chips, is almost exactly the same. What is the advantage of this technique? Well, there's one more that I haven't told you. This technique has the ability to distinguish one or more nucleotide differences. It's very powerful. Without any size difference, without any length difference, it can take any two alleles that differ with one or more nucleotides and distinguish them just as you're looking on this screen. And so if you're going to send, for example, your DNA to a parentage testing lab, this is probably what they're going to use. If you're going to send your DNA to a genealogy lab, this is probably what they're going to use, or they may use something that's based on this, but it's a very powerful technique. Now, how does it work? And I want you to pay attention, because this gets a little bit technically challenging. And so think about this, because you all know about this. Daisy, what's the structure of DNA?
It's a double helix.
What's holding together the chains of the DNA?
Do you mean each nucleotide?
What's holding the double helix together?
Well, there's hydrogen bonds and phosphodiester bonds.
Hydrogen bonds are holding the double helix together. Is that correct? Would you say that the more hydrogen bonds that you have, the more stable the double helix might be?
Sure.
Are you sure? I don't want you to guess on this. I want an intelligent answer. Okay, conceptually, why would that be? Provide an explanation.
Because it would take more energy to break down one bond.
Exactly.
More.
If you have more hydrogen bonds, it takes more energy to separate the double helix than if you have fewer hydrogen bonds. Karina, can you take a double helix and separate it into two single strands? I can't hear you.
Yes.
How would I do that?
You can heat it up.
You can heat it up, exactly, at 100 degrees, and you can separate it into different strands, correct? Again, if you have a lot of hydrogen bonds, is it going to take more energy or less energy? Karina?
More.
You sure?
What was the question?
If you have a lot of hydrogen bonds, is it going to take more energy or less energy?
To break it, you need more.
Okay, more, correct?
Energy.
Okay, now, here becomes a little bit of a tricky question, but it's the same concept, exactly the same concept. If I have a nucleic acid which is very short, let's say 15 base pairs in length, and I have another one which is also very short, and I have a mismatch, meaning that might be a T and that might be a G, but everything pairs up. Karina, if I heat these two, which molecule will the strand separate before the other?
The second one.
Why?
Because there's fewer hydrogen bonds.
Exactly. In this very short molecule, there's only 15 hydrogen bonds here, and there's 14 hydrogen bonds here. Therefore, it takes less energy to break this molecule into single strands than it does this. Would you agree with that? Would everyone agree with that? Ben, would you agree? Radina, would you agree? Heather, would you agree? So might it also be possible, let me ask you another question and then I'll bring it together. If you separate the strands of the DNA, Kyle, let me ask Sam. Sam, if I separate the strands of the DNA, how do I bring them back together again? What's that process called?
You repair the bonds, the hydrogen
bonds. No, well, how do I bring those two back together? It's not repairing. I know you're using the word in the way, I know why you want to say, but it's not repairing. What's that concept called? Separation and bring them back. There's a specific word.
Yeah, I'm blanking on it right now.
You had it on your exam. I know that because I read your answer. What is that word? It starts with an A and it ends with a G. You've put it on every quiz you've had the entire quarter.
Allele, anneal, annealing.
Yes, annealing.
There we go. Yeah.
Exactly. So
I got it.
Exactly.
I was thinking
so
too much.
So you anneal. And how do you think you anneal? Would you anneal at this high temperature? Or would you have to bring the temperature down conceptually?
Bring the temperature down.
Okay, so you'd have to bring it down. And let's say you bring it down to like 60 degrees or something like that. So this nucleic acid would be stable at that temperature, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's now back to a double helix again.
Yep.
Certain stability here. It's stable forever. But in this instance, if I break these strands, just use that for the sake of argument, and I anneal them together, okay? I anneal them together. What would you think would be the difference between the temperature at which this would anneal and that would anneal, Sam? Just take a guess.
Well, if it had to be
perfect,
it didn't have to be as high.
It has to be perfect.
It didn't have to be as high to break the bonds. I would imagine it wouldn't have to be as low to anneal the bonds.
Right.
So it would be higher.
So that means that this would anneal at a higher temperature, right, than this one. Right?
Well, I guessed it would be the other way around, actually. But
well, say it again.
Well, if it takes less...
takes less energy to break.
Yeah, it takes less energy
to break.
The
one that's mismatched.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
That means that the one that's perfectly matched should be stabler at a higher temperature than the one that has the mismatch. Because the one that has a mismatch is getting a high energy at the high temperature and therefore is not stable.
Okay, yeah, I see.
Okay, does everyone follow that? It's very important. Brian, you follow that? What I'm saying here is that all nucleic acids have a certain stability. And it's dependent upon, let's say, the temperature at which they're put into. And the stability of something like this is greater than something like that. We're all in agreement at a particular temperature. When you separate these strands and you bring them back together, the perfectly matched DNA will be able to form this hybrid with itself at a higher temperature because it's more stable. That high temperature is allowing these hydrogen bonds to come back again. But the mismatched hybrid can't form at that higher temperature because the higher temperature is putting more energy into the solution, and the hydrogen bonds are more unstable, and therefore it can't form that hybrid at the higher temperature. You have to go to a lower temperature. So let's assume that you do this at 100 degrees and you separate the strands. And let's assume you bring the temperature down to 70 degrees and allow the strands to go together. At that temperature, only this kind of hybrid will form at 70 degrees, at that temperature. But at 70 degrees, this particular hybrid will not form at all because it's unstable. The hydrogen bonds just can't join up because there's not enough to hold those things together like a paperclip. On the other hand, at 60 degrees, that will form. And that will form. And the reason why that forms at a lower temperature is there's not enough energy to break those hydrogen bonds. It's stable, even with the mismatch. The point here is that what this allows you to do is distinguish between sequences of nucleotides that differ by only one base pair, simply by playing with the temperature. If and only if, Hannah, if and only if the sequence is very short. If it's long, like 50 or 75 or 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000, it doesn't work because now there's a lot of hydrogen bonds. It only works for short nucleic acids, and that's called an oligonucleotide. A short nucleic acid is called an oligonucleotide. So let me, I'm going to go over this again, but let me just conceptualize for you. A double helix is stable because of the hydrogen bonds. If you boil a double helix, let's just say exaggerating, you break the double the hydrogen bonds and you get single strands. If you then cool the double helix down, lower the temperature, reduce the energy, the complementary base pairs can form again. With a short nucleic acid, it doesn't take a lot of energy to break those double bonds, I mean those hydrogen bonds, which means as you cool it down, it can form at a reasonably high temperature. On the other hand, if you have a mismatch, that mismatch isn't going to allow the formation of a stable double helix at the higher temperature because it's just not stable because of that mismatch. That one difference in hydrogen bond out of 14 to 15 makes it less stable. So what we're doing here is we're playing with the properties, and this is why it was so important for you to understand the double helix. What we're doing is we're playing with the properties of a double helix, only a very short double helix. A perfectly matched double helix is more stable at a given temperature than a mismatched double helix. And if you know what that temperature is, you can play the game of allowing a perfectly matched short double helix to form at that temperature, but a mismatched one never forms. That automatically gives you an assay for different alleles based on no RFLP, based on no difference in restriction fragment like polymorphism, simply a difference in how stable the double helix is by annealing. So let me say it again. This is the most technically challenging thing I'll say today. A double helix is stable because of its hydrogen bonds. And therefore, that double helix is stable under a certain temperature. For a short double helix, 15, 16, 17, 20 base pairs, that short double helix is always stabler, more stable, than one which has one or more mismatches. The stable double helix can form a double helix at a higher temperature than an unstable double helix. An unstable double helix can't form a stable structure at a high temperature because energy is coming in and is breaking it and preventing it from forming a double-stranded molecule. Therefore, if you know the temperature at which the perfect match is stable, but the mismatch can't even form a double helix, you now have a marker. It's no different than a restriction fragment length polymorphism. The marker is formation of the double helix or not formation of the double helix. That's a marker. That's no different than orange tomatoes and yellow tomatoes. It's no different than tall peas and short peas. It's no different than one fragment of a DNA restriction fragment and two fragments. It's a marker. It either hybridizes or it doesn't hybridize. I know, Gavino, you never thought about it that way, but that's exactly how it works. And so the point here is that you have a marker, formation of a duplex or lack of formation of a duplex. One thing more. If you can detect the formation of the duplex and distinguish it from the formation of the lack of the duplex, you have the marker and you have the assay, and you have the assay for specific alleles. Because if you use these short oligonucleotides, only one nucleotide difference. This is a powerful technique coupled with the polymerase chain reaction. You don't need anything. It's much easier than what we did in this class. Infinitely easier. That's powerful for one locus at a time. Can't use it for several loci. Well, you can, but you have to do many, many things. Go ahead. This is fun.
I just wanted to know if
all mutations have a mismatch, or what if
it could be a deletion too?
What if there's a different sequence, but it's perfectly
still
matched?
Different sequences will not match. It's complementary base pairs. If you have any difference in nucleotide sequence, you can't form a complementary base pair.
But doesn't when the DNA copies, the polymerase matches it, right? So what if...
There's your mismatch, right? This is sequence one. I know what you're saying, Ben. We'll come to that in a second. Sequence two. This is sequence one, sequence one. Yes, what you're saying is absolutely correct. Two will form a perfect match with two. That's absolutely correct. I only showed you one strand there of the two allele, conceptually. I'd complicate it if I added the other one. Lisa, did you understand absolutely everything that I just said, or are you completely in a daze? Because I don't want you to be in a daze. I'm trying to be very conceptual here. I don't think he's telling me the truth. Charles, did you understand? Conceptually, do you understand the principle?
Oh, yeah.
That's all I care about. Matt?
I have a quick follow-up question. I can see where an SNP originally occurs. You'll get that formation there.
SNP. SNP. What did you... Did I miss what you said?
SNP. Single nucleotide polymorphism.
Have we ever talked about those in this class?
Yeah, didn't we?
Did we? I don't think so. I think maybe in discussion, but we'll go into that on Thursday.
Okay, well...
Go ahead.
What I'm wondering is...
If you have a series of
If you
three,
have that right there, once it replicates again, wouldn't it correct itself? Wouldn't the G then go to the C and the T would go to an A?
No, because the polymerase chain reaction is copying this molecule perfectly, the one, and copying... the two perfectly. So nothing's being corrected.
What I'm saying is, say there's a mistake when the cell's replicating, right? And you
that
get that
occurs
right
maybe one out of a billion times.
So then how do you get that mismatch to start with?
Because you're starting with two different nucleotide sequences. Sequence that has a difference in one nucleotide. Because the alleles are different in one nucleotide, and you've used the polymerase chain reaction to
amplify. Okay, so the other strand's like the marker that you're using.
No, using one strand. I'm illustrating. You'll see this in a sec.
Okay.
Other question. Go ahead. Nothing's being corrected here. Zippo, nothing's being corrected. Dealing with two different nucleotide sequences that differ in one base pair. All we're asking is for... Can they form a double helix, or can they not with each other? And the situation here is that you can form what we call a homoduplex, that is a self-duplex that works, but the heteroduplex between 1 and 2 does not work. And you'll see this in a second. I haven't finished it, Matt. Go ahead.
I just had a question. If you have a 15 base pair nucleic acid and a 14 base pair one, and none of them have a mismatch. Is the 15 base pair one more stable?
So the 15 and a 14, basically not under the temperature. It's a very good question. You're starting out with 15 and 15, okay? This sequence has an extra nucleotide here, so it's still 15 bases in length. So this is going to be just as stable with itself as this one will be with itself. But it's only the heteroduplex which becomes unstable. You'll see this in a second. You guys are confused. I can see it all over your faces, so ask some questions. Shauna, this is all going to clear up when I give you the specific example.
Are there two temperatures at which this can serve as a marker, the higher end and the lower end?
No, it would be one temperature. Under one temperature, the homoduplex is both formed.
So it's only when it reanneals?
So it's only when you get the heteroduplexes formed does it not form at the higher temperature.
Okay.
So that means that you can theoretically then assay for allele 1 genotype, and you can assay for, let's say, allele 2 genotype, but allele 1 allele 2, you'd get nothing So you can assay for that as well. So you'd get a positive result here, positive result there, and a negative result there. So you can assay as long as you know what you're starting with, which I haven't showed you yet. Okay, let me show you how this works. So conceptually then, this is a situation. We have a sequenced gene, and we have multiple alleles of that sequenced gene. And we know what the sequence is. So you must start with cloning and genetic engineering and sequencing. This is not a random process. Remember, you cannot use the polymerase chain reaction. You cannot use the polymerase chain reaction unless you've cloned the gene and you've sequenced it, because you need specific primers and you need the knowledge of the sequence. Okay? In this situation, what you do is you have a short sequence. There it is. There's the short one right over here. And under certain conditions, that short one can form a duplex with itself and be very stable. Okay, there it is. Under certain conditions, it can form a duplex with itself and be perfectly stable. However, if you have another allele, and if you have the sequence of that allele in the same annealing reaction, that other allele will try and form a hybrid with its allelic pair, but because the sequence is different by one or more nucleotides, it's unstable. It can form it with itself. It's not being shown up here, but it's not going to be stable with the other allele. So what I'm saying here is, if this is allele 1, it can form a very stable duplex with itself that is 1 and 1 prime, Watson and Crick, complementary base pairs, but it's not going to be stable with its other allele because of the mismatch. That's essentially the concept. So you can use temperature to distinguish between the formation of a homoduplex and distinguish it from the formation of a double helix, where this mismatch, Matt, is a specific sequence. This is allele 2. That's allele 1. It just can't form a hybrid here because there's been a change in the nucleic acid sequence. But it could form with itself if it was diagrammed up here. Okay? Is that clear or not clear? So you have to just use your imagination. Matt, is that clear?
Yeah. So just sort of like the second strand is the probe.
There is no probe. Probe is a radioactive molecule. There is no radioactive molecule here, as you'll see in a second. Technically, there's no probe. Technically, both of these ASOs are probe, allele-specific oligonucleotide. Technically, they're both probes, but they're not probes in the sense of being radioactive.
Is one being artificially supplied, though?
You'll see in a sec. Okay? You'll see in a sec. Okay, now let me go over how this works in reality. So let me give you a specific example. The first thing is, you need to know the DNA sequence of the alleles you're assaying. That's the most important thing. And secondly, you need to know the DNA sequence of the alleles where they differ. You need to know that. And the only way you can find that is by cloning both alleles and sequencing them. So in the case of sickle cell anemia, you need to know the sequence of the sickle cell allele in the region in which it's different from the wild type allele. In the case of sickle cell anemia, you need to know the sequence of the wild type allele. That's a very important thing, because what you have to do is synthesize these short oligonucleotides by using a gene machine. You have to synthesize these very, very, very accurately. So the first thing you have to start with is a clone of the alleles that you're interested in, or a polymerase chain amplified molecules of what the alleles that you're interested in. So you've had to clone the gene and you've had to sequence the gene. And so somewhere in this gene, let's say that's the gene, somewhere in this gene there's this polymorphism. Let's say this one base pair that differs from this allele right over here. That's Y and that's X. This is allele 1, that's allele 2. So sometime you have to know what this sequence is. You have to know that. And the reason that you have to know that is you have to synthesize, yes, Matt, you're correct, you have to synthesize an allele-specific oligonucleotide. And so you have to synthesize an ASO for allele 1, and you have to synthesize an ASO for allele 2. Now, those ASOs are identical, let's say, across 15 to 20 base pairs, except ASO1 has an X and ASO2 has a Y. So, for example, this could be a T and that could be an A, or it could be a deletion, or it could be an addition. It doesn't matter. So you have to know the sequence of those alleles, and then you have to synthesize short allele-specific oligonucleotides, 15 to 20 base pairs, chemically, using a gene machine, one by one, and those technically, Matt, technically, those would be your probes, technically. It's okay. You can use it. Those would be your probes. And you don't use a non-radioactive assay that I'm not going to go into because it's too complicated. So use a colorimetric assay that I'm not going to go into. It's actually an enzymatic assay, but it's just a little too complicated to go into. So the way it works is, let's say you're assaying for sickle cell anemia and carriers of sickle cell anemia. So the first thing is you'd go in and you'd isolate DNA from all the individuals that you wanted to test. Okay? So you'd isolate DNA from all the individuals that you wanted to test, and you would use the polymerase chain reaction to amplify the region containing the gene you're interested in assaying. So if I wanted to assay in this room for sickle cell trait, I would isolate DNA from all the people in this room, and I would use the polymerase chain reaction to amplify from everyone in the room the globin gene, using primers that are specific to the globin gene. But more than that, I would amplify the gene from only the region that carries, let's say, the polymorphism. So in this particular case, and this is just a test, we have healthy individuals, heterozygous carriers, and, let's say, people who are affected and homozygous for the mutant allele. So I've already isolated their DNA, and I've used the polymerase chain reaction from their whole DNA, and I've amplified their DNA. Each of those samples is then spotted on a filter paper. So individual 1's amplified DNA is spotted here, individual 2 DNA is spotted there, individual 3 DNA is spotted there. Okay? Individual 1, 2, and 3, it's replicated very, very, very nicely. It's replicated. Then what we do is we, in fact, start to allele. We allele. And we allele these oligonucleotides with those particular samples. So remember that in this particular case, the heterozygotes have a wild-type allele. Heterozygotes have a wild-type allele. Two copies. And the homozygotes have a wild-type allele and two copies. The heterozygotes have one wild-type and one mutant allele, and the homozygotes have two mutant alleles. Each of those alleles is a double-stranded nucleic acid. Okay? Each of those alleles is a double-stranded nucleic acid. Each of these particular filter papers is hybridized under high conditions with each of the allele-specific oligonucleotides. So we have two sets of reactions going on. Under these conditions, this ASO only forms a hybrid with the wild-type allele. Under these conditions, this ASO only forms a hybrid with the mutant allele. Anything that has a mismatch is unstable. And so therefore, because of that, this one is being hybridized with the wild-type allele. This one shows a positive reaction, wild-type allele. This one shows a positive reaction because we have one copy of the wild-type allele, and you get nothing here because the wild-type ASO cannot form a hybrid with the DNA from the mutant region because of one mismatch. So you can read off immediately the genotype, SS, big S, small s, small s, small s. Of course, you have to have, you know, controls in order to do this, and what I'm showing you is the controls. In other words, someone did this and showed that it worked. So you're starting with knowns. So when I started this experiment, I started with a known homozygote, a known heterozygote, and a known mutant homozygote, duplicated on two filters. This filter is hybridized to the wild type ASO. That will hybridize, that will hybridize, that won't, because the DNA sequence on that side of the filter has a mismatch with this wild type normal ASO. Conversely, the mutant ASO will not hybridize with the wild type allele. So therefore, the wild type homozygous gets no results just because of this mismatching. The heterozygote will show a positive result because of the presence of this one mutant allele. And of course, the homozygous mutant individual will show a positive result because of the presence of both of those mutant alleles. Each of these letters is a double-stranded DNA. So when I say SS, that's two double helices. When I say big S, little s, that's two double helices. In the case of this two double helices, only this is forming a hybrid with itself. This is not working at all because of the mismatch. And the proof of that is here's two mutant double helices which can't form any hybrid with the normal oligonucleotide. So we're dealing with double helical molecules. Each allele is a double helix. It's a pretty nifty test. It's cheap, it's fast, no radioactive probe. It's a colorimetric assay, and you can immediately assay for the genotype of these individuals, and there it is. Sam, do you see it conceptually? Do you see how much faster that is than an RFLP assay? See how much cheaper it can be? See how that could be adapted to clinical uses? Again, I don't want to confuse you here. This S is not a single-stranded DNA, and that's not a single. These are two double-stranded DNA molecules. Each of those double-stranded DNA molecules, one from the genome and one from the allele-specific oligonucleotide. So that first little round dot would look like this. Here's the DNA from the globin gene in the genome. Let's say that's the normal one. And what would then happen would be you'd have the allele-specific oligonucleotide, which would form a hybrid right here. So this is what's on the filter, this black thing, and this is the, let's say, short ASO, which allows you to do this colorimetric reaction, and it's perfectly matched. The reason why you don't get anything from the mutant, let's say this is the mutant globin gene, is because the normal ASO, let's say that's the normal one, the normal one's going to come along, it's going to be a mismatch right there, normal to mutant, and it's not stable. So you don't even see it. So it's a black and white assay. So this black dot here represents two of these, basically. Two of those, essentially. But you can't distinguish them. Okay? The heterozygote has one of these. That one can't form with the wild-type oligonucleotide. And, of course, you get nothing with the mutant because they can't form under those conditions. It's really nifty. It's really fast. The only thing you have to know is that it's conceptual. You have short oligonucleotides under these hybridization annealing conditions are only stable if there's 100% perfect Watson-Crick complementary base pairs. Any one mismatch or more than one will not make a double helix. If you don't make a double helix, you can't get one of these colorimetric assays to work because there's no hybrid because it doesn't even stick to the filter. Matt, do you see it? Matt, you see it now? So you can form one ones, two twos, but no one twos or two ones under these conditions, basically. So it's a really nifty test. Now, the reason why I show that to you is because this is what's used. Because it's fast, it's cheap, no radioactivity, and again, there's no restriction fragment length polymorphism. The polymorphism is, in fact, the SNP, the single nucleotide polymorphism, or more. Could be an addition, it could be a deletion, could be three nucleotides difference, could be four. Whatever it is, the presence of that difference allows you, in fact, to get this black-white assay. So I just showed you a mock hybridization using known individuals. Let's try this again using, let's say, cystic fibrosis. So this is the cystic fibrosis gene. We've talked a little bit about it. It's a huge gene with lots of exons and introns. Lots of exons and introns. And 70% of the population, remember there's a founder mutation, 70% of the population of individuals on the face of this earth have a mutation right over here in this part of the gene. And in that part of the gene, that mutation is a three nucleotide deletion right there. So that's 70% of the mutations giving rise to cystic fibrosis. The other 30% are mutations that occur anywhere that are family specific. And so remember, we talked about in DNA testing that if you have a founder mutation, you can use the same assay for all the families. But if you don't have a founder mutation, you're up a creek because each mutation will be specific for an individual family, and therefore there could be no common assay for that. What you basically have to do is sequence the genes. So in this case, there's a founder mutation for cystic fibrosis. And that founder mutation changes one of the exons, and by changing one of the exons, you change this particular messenger RNA and this protein, and this particular protein is a membrane protein, and as I said earlier on, it helps transport ions across membranes, and when you don't have this, you can't transport water in ions across membranes, and all kinds of things build up, and essentially individuals with CF very rarely live past the age of 35. It's a lethal disease. Nothing to mess around with. CF is a lethal disease. It's just lethal later in life. In the old days, before there were some recombinant DNA treatments, the kids died. Now we can keep people alive a little bit longer due to the miracles of biotechnology. So what you have here is the same kind of assay. And there it is. So you have this three base pair deletion in this particular exon. And there it is. There's the wild type allele, ATCTTT. Here's the mutant allele, AT. It's missing these three nucleotides, TTGG. So you synthesize two ASOs. One might be a 15 base sequence GAAATAT. Another one might be a 15 base sequence, which of course is missing these three. And you anneal these to the DNAs that you've isolated from a family, a pedigree, and you've amplified this cystic fibrosis region right in here using the polymerase chain reaction. You put the DNAs from all those individuals on these little filter strips. In this case, we have a duplication of the DNAs. We have a series of these individuals on the top and a series of individuals on the bottom. You take these strips and you hybridize them separately with the mutant ASO and with the wild-type ASO, showing them together, but they're not. The strips are just put together after you do this assay. And what you have here is the normal ASO can hybridize with this individual's DNA, that individual's DNA, that individual's DNA, that individual's DNA, not this one, and that individual. The mutant can hybridize with that one, not that one, that one, that one, that one, and that one. So we know that this is a heterozygote. We know that that's homozygote wild type, heterozygote, heterozygote, homozygous CF, heterozygote, very quickly, very fast, very cheap, very simple, powerful. And this is how a genetic counselor could use this information in some family to advise any of these carriers here whether they should have children or not, or go to a different assay. And what would the different assay be? The different assay would be PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, because the power of this technique is that it can be used in clinical conditions with one cell equivalent of DNA, because Anton, you're using the polymerase chain reaction. Without the polymerase chain reaction, you could never do this. So the power of this is you can do in vitro fertilization, just as Dr. Evans talked about and you read about and discussed in discussion. You can make an 8-celled embryo. You can assay one cell, meaning take the DNA from that one cell, and you can amplify any gene region you want. And if you have oligospecific, allele-specific oligonucleotides for alleles at that locus, you can assay for any allele that you want with this very simple test. So you use a polymerase chain reaction, which is right here. You duplicate the samples because you have to hybridize them to two different ASOs or maybe more. So maybe you have to triplicate them or, you know, put them in fours and fives and sixes. But with the polymerase chain reaction, you're not limited with the amount of DNA you can get. You can take a single cell and you can get an infinite amount of DNA using PCR. That's why it's so powerful. And so you take this DNA and you spot it, let's say here, hybridized to the mutant ASO, hybridized to the normal ASO, and now we have embryos. There's cell 1, cell 2, cell 3, 4, 5, 6 different embryos. 6 different 8-cell embryos. This embryo is homozygous cystic fibrosis. This embryo is homozygous wild type. That embryo is homozygous cystic fibrosis. Here's a heterozygous carrier, homozygous wild type. Here's homozygous mutant. And now you know that you could take this embryo, maybe that embryo, and implant it back in the mother, and you have 100% certainty that the individual will not have cystic fibrosis. That is powerful. That is incredibly powerful technology. Because what it does is it eliminates all the uncertainties and it eliminates the decision that the woman has to make if she's carrying this baby of what to do with it if you assay it a little bit later in pregnancy using amniocentesis or using chorionic villi sampling. So it's a very powerful, powerful procedure which can be used for individuals, any individuals, but used for individuals that have particular genes in families that may be deleterious. And again, I know you all hear is CF. In fact, sickle cell anemia can be a potentially lethal disease because those individuals that have homozygous sickling traits have all kinds of health problems. I mean, they can survive and they can live, but it isn't a lot of fun. And that's why it's important to try and assay for these alleles. So what we have here is the old-fashioned assay, and now we're looking at sickle cell anemia. There it is. So Matt Emmer, notice we have in the old assay, we have to have a probe, radioactive. We have to have a restriction enzyme site polymorphism. We have to run a gel, and we have to do a blot. And we look at a marker, which is the difference between having a large band and two small bands. So it's a difference in a restriction enzyme site. Still the same difference in one nucleotide, but you're using a different assay. The marker here is the difference in the size of the bands. There's the mutant band, two bands are wild type, or vice versa, depending upon the condition. That takes 1 to 2 weeks. But now, James, we have this other assay, ASO, wild type, heterozygous, mutant, mutant, heterozygous, wild type. Takes 5 minutes. Same nucleotide difference. One nucleotide difference, but in this case, you're not using any restriction enzymes. You're not using any gel. No radioactive probe. Fast, simple. In this case, the marker is a difference in size of DNA bands. In this case, the marker is the ability of the ASO to either hybridize and form a stable duplex or not. That's all it is. And you assay by color. Any questions? Sky, do you see it? conceptually. Najla, you see it? Jessica? It's a simple, powerful, powerful assay. You do a parentage test, say, well, you know, I'm not the father of your kid. That's what's going to be done, basically. If you want to do anything else, assay for some genetic disease or some disease allele, that's what's going to be done. That can be coupled with other kinds of things that I'll show you in a few minutes, but the point is that it's powerful. Now, let me wrap this up and then I'll give you a break. The human genome has been sequenced. As you know, we've talked about many times in this class. The human genome has been sequenced, and by knowledge of that sequence, one can go back and look at any gene in any individual. So that means theoretically, we could identify every allele for any gene for all of you in this room, and we did it for one particular locus when we DNA tested you. But you could do it with all 35,000 or whatever. So that means that DNA testing has moved beyond this one-by-one gene assay. That's because of microarrays. Because now, in fact, we've been doing it in our laboratory. We usually work with plants, but I've been collaborating with someone in the medical school, and we're doing this amazing microarray study, which we've never done before with human chips. So we've been using chips with all human genes on them. The purpose of the study is to try and identify genes that are differentially expressed in intestine cells between individuals that have AIDS and individuals that don't, because your intestinal cells is really where most of your immune cells in your body is located. And I can go into more of that later. But the point is you have these microarrays, and you have these, or chips, gene chips, and you talked about this in discussion, at least two discussions, and you have on this little chip the sequence of every gene in the human genome. But it's not the whole gene. Lota, it is only a short oligonucleotide sequence of the gene. Short. 20 bases. Specific allele. It's one allele or more. So, Summer, can you see how gene chips can be used to determine genotype now? It's the same as the ASO. Only each position on the chip can assay a specific gene. It's either stable or not stable, hybridizing to, we'll use Matt's word, the probe. And what is the probe in this case? The probe is the whole genomic DNA. So if you did a genome chip in order to identify the genotype of all of you at all of your loci, what I would do is I'd say, Ben, give me a sample of your DNA. Could be from your white blood cell, whatever. I would then amplify all of your DNA. I'm not going to tell you how I do it, but every single solitary gene using some fancy enzymology steps, and I'd put a fluorescent tag on it. And I would hybridize it to this chip. And only the sequences that you had that were specific for your alleles would either hybridize to the alleles on that chip or not. And by going back and reading basically yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, over 35,000 genes, I could determine in one day, in 15 minutes, your entire genotype. That's powerful. Do you understand what that means? Do you have any idea? This ASO stuff that I just showed you is nursery school stuff, because you got to do it one gene at a time. This other assay, I can assay for every single solitary gene in Shauna's genome, Ben's genome, Daisy's, all of you. It's still pretty expensive. It's about $1,000 per chip. It's not cheap enough to do on a full scale, but it's getting there. What that means is that I can look at the genotype and I can know what your alleles are. And I can say with almost 100% certainty, because you repeat these things, not like you do it once. When we do these microarray experiments, we generally run 3 replicates, sometimes 4. So we get a good assay without any false positives. But what I can say with almost 100% certainty then in doing this, and this again is from your textbook, which is excellent, by the way, is that I can take someone's DNA and I can start saying, well, this individual has cystic fibrosis, 2 copies of this allele. Or this individual is heterozygous for this. Or this individual might have susceptibility to that. But I'm looking at every single solitary gene in someone's genome. It's unbelievable. Changes everything that one can do in medicine. And anybody in this room that's going to go on to medical school and be a doctor, like Brian and a couple others, you won't get to practice medicine for about 10 to 15 years by the time you're done with your training. This is the medicine that's going to be practiced, because you're going to be looking at the susceptibility to drugs, which are simply, if you're sensitive to a drug, it's just that you can't break it down metabolically, which means you don't have an enzyme that can break it down, whatever. But the point here is that this is what's known as now 21st century genotyping, but the microarray is really 35,000 ASOs going on at the same time. That's all that is. This changes the ballgame. Susceptibility to heart disease. Susceptibility to this. Susceptibility to that. Susceptibility to that, 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 and that. Let's take a break, pick up the other half of your packet, and we'll come back and talk about testing for individuals. Okay, so now DNA in the law not only involves these tests for medical purposes, but clearly there's the other type of tests that deal with individuality, identifying individuals, either in populations or separately or whatever. Why would you want to identify an individual? One, for family lineage. You know, where do you come from? You know, is this group of Celts related to another group of individuals? How did human origins occur? That's individual identity using DNA testing. Who committed the crime? Using DNA to pinpoint an individual that might be at a crime. Whose remains are these that might have been someone that had been the subject of a horrible, let's say, war crime or atrocity? Anything like that, or not even in humans, it can be used for identification of animals and ancient mummies and mammoths and all kinds of things like that. But the assay is a little bit different. So now we're no longer assaying for individual genes, but we're asking for regions of the genome that allow us to identify individuality. And generally, those are not gene regions. So when you assay for individuality, you're generally assaying for regions that are between genes, okay, that have nothing to do with coding for proteins. So these things called variable number tandem repeats generally don't code for proteins, although they could, theoretically. Generally, they don't. It's not important to get into why. So the point here is that we have also some very powerful technology, and there you go, that was some of you, that can assay for individual, and now what we're assaying for is individual alleles. And alleles can be anywhere in the genome. They don't have to be residing in a gene that codes for a protein. Any sequence that's different from someone else's sequence in a population is an allele. Say that again. Any sequence that I have of a specific region of my genome that differs from a specific region of T's genome is an allele. Doesn't have to be in a protein coding gene. Anywhere in the genome where we differ in the exact same region by one or more nucleotides is an allele. And in fact, most of the polymorphisms in the human genome don't reside in protein coding genes, but they reside outside, either in introns or between genes or in non-protein coding regions. And there's very good reasons for that. The protein coding regions are needed, and if you mutate them, you get a mutation, and it's not that desirable in most cases. But outside protein coding regions, either in introns or between genes, it doesn't matter what you do generally, as long as it's not in a switch. And that's where mutations can build up because there's no selection against them in any way. And so most of the polymorphisms, whether they're due to mutations or additions, deletions, whatever, most of what we see in the human genome are not in protein coding regions. And those things that are different between individuals can be used as markers of individuality at specific loci. But those loci can be not in, can be different than protein coding regions. So in this case, we assayed for U for a specific VNTR, variable number tandem repeat, in a particular region of your genome that had nothing to do with making proteins. And as you know from your take-home tests, the variable numbers were person-specific. And furthermore, that can be done in many different ways for parentage, for forensics, for whatever, and I'm not going to go into this because I'll go into it a little more later. So the point here is that you have these different assays. And they're now very, 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 very sophisticated. So in the old days, which I'll show you in a second just to remind you, the old days relied on the DNA blot. The old days relied on the DNA blot that all of you are familiar with, hybridized in the membranes in allele, and all of that was very expensive, very time-consuming, and very, 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 very expensive. But now, with the polymerase chain reaction, right over here, all you have to do is amplify specific regions and use sequencing machines to detect the differences using fluorescent, we'll use the word probes, but they're not really probes per se, but using fluorescents that are specific for individual loci. So what I'm saying here is this was the old way. Extract the DNA from white blood cells, digest with restriction enzymes, hybridize to specific VNTR probes. Now that's not used anymore. What's used to test for individuality could be, let's say, the ASO test that I showed you. It could be the gene chip that I showed you, but typically it'll be this procedure down here called automatic detection of polymorphisms, automatic detection of individual loci using the polymerase chain reaction. Without PCR, none of this could be done. We'd be back in the dark ages, as we talked about. So let me remind you then of the way in which you know how to do it. So we have individual 1 and individual 2. We have locus 1 and locus 2, independent loci. That means that the VNTR at that locus is different in sequence. That VNTR could be 2 nucleotides in length. It could be 15 nucleotides in length. It could be 100 nucleotides in length. What I'm saying is any sequence which is repeated over and over again is a variable number tandem repeats. Like AA, 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 GC, 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 GC. Those are variable number tandem repeats. And you can assay them because the individuals, as you know, can differ in the number of those variable number tandem repeats. So in the case of the VNTR assay that you used and did for your take-home test, we have restriction enzyme sites that are conserved. The restriction enzyme sites are conserved for every allele at that locus. And what's different is simply the number of repeats that are between the sites. And you know this from discussion in your take-home test. And therefore, it's the length of the fragment between these two sites which governs the individuality. And the more VNTRs you use, the greater the accuracy of pinpointing the genotype of a specific individual with almost 100% certainty. And so in this case, we have two alleles from the A locus and two alleles from the B locus, and you can distinguish this individual from that individual, again, using this cumbersome DNA blotting procedure. However, I'll come back to that in a second. Now this can be done much simpler, much, much simpler, using the polymerase chain reaction. So now we have a very simple, in this case, VNTR, very simple VNTR, in this case, CACACACACA. You can see that allele 2 has more of these little dinucleotides than allele 1. You use a conserved region outside the VNTR to amplify your DNA. So you're using a primer that's exactly the same sequence for every allele to do your polymerase chain reaction. And so you amplify, essentially, between this primer and that primer, this allele. You amplify between this primer and that primer, that allele, using the polymerase chain reaction. And the product will be the size of the band between those conserved primers. So in this case, it'll be a larger one for this one, and it'll be a smaller one for this one. What was that all about? Okay? No idea what that was. Zero. Okay, but we don't need that. Doesn't matter. I don't need it. If you can get it on in some way, that would be great. Who flipped it off? Went off by itself. Let's turn it back on. So it was a projector that went off. Okay, so we have the polymerase chain reaction, and using the polymerase chain reaction, we can amplify these alleles, and by amplifying these alleles, we can get specific bands of specific sizes, all fine and all good. But you still need a gel system in order to do that. And by using a gel system, it takes time, and it takes energy, and it takes money, and you have to do a variety of different things. So what you can do then is basically do the same thing, except what you do is you use a fluorescent assay, which is on your handout page, a fluorescent assay, and instead of loading the products on a gel, you load them on a different kind of gel, but a sequencing gel, a gel in a sequencing machine. So you load them, and the fragments can separate by size through this sequencing machine, because you know that's the principle of DNA sequencing, and then they're eluted off of this gel. Fragments are eluted, and there's a laser. And the laser is of a specific wavelength, of a very specific wavelength, and that laser allows you to detect the size of the fragment as it comes off. So as this fragment comes off, the laser will pick up this fragment, and a much longer period of time will take to get this fragment to come off the gel, and that one will come off. And then you can convert this into a graph. And so there is the first fragment that comes off, and there is the second fragment that comes off. And so what you now know is this individual has, let's say, allele A and allele small a. Every individual has two independent alleles. But it's now done automatedly. It's all automated. It's all done using fluorescence. And it's all done in a sequencing machine. It's picked up by a laser, and it's automatically fed into a computer, and no one even has to look at it except looking at the computer screen. Now, how do you get the fluorescence? You get the fluorescence by the primers you use for the PCR. So the primers that you use with PCR, some of these nucleotides have fluorescent molecules attached to them. And so when you run the polymerase chain reaction, this molecule here will have a fluorescence at the end of that particular molecule. And this fluorescence at the end can be detected by this laser. Now the power of this is, that you can assay for several different loci all at the same time. Because if you use, let's say this is locus 1, let's say you use the blue fluorescence, let's say this is locus number 2, you use the, in this case, the red fluorescence, okay? So that's locus number 2. You use locus number 3 crudely. You use the green fluorescence as your primer for your PCR reaction. You can now, thanks Jack, I appreciate that. You can now assay for those alleles at those three independent loci all at the same time, because as they come off the sequencing gel, this laser detects specific wavelengths. So this fluorescent tag on this PCR product fluoresces at the blue wavelength. This fluorescent tag off of this PCR product fluoresces at the red wavelength, and this one fluoresces at the green wavelength. So you can look at all alleles at any locus you want all at the same time. It's kind of like a poor man's chip, so to speak. And you do that by using this fluorescence and using a sequencing machine. And so there it is in reality. So you can see red, green, and blue on that diagram, red, green, and blue. Here are all the alleles at the, let's say, blue locus. Here's all the alleles at the green locus. Here's all the alleles at the red locus. And here's the alleles that would be marking the X and Y chromosome in yellow. You extract the DNA from an individual. You use the polymerase chain reaction with four sets of independent primers, three sets of primers for, let's say, autosomal loci, one set for sex loci, X and Y chromosome, okay, so to speak. And you then can amplify them, put them through this sequencing gel, and what you can see is that this individual has that allele and that allele of this locus, that allele and that allele of that locus, that allele of that locus, and generally that would be an XY individual. And so you can do this very rapidly. And that's what Harry Klann was talking about when he said we use this thing called STR, short tandem repeat, same as VNTR, STR, automated genotyping. So here we have 32 alleles at 16 loci. So we have two alleles, two alleles, two, 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 five different loci, two, two, two. So what you're doing is you're choosing loci that give you alleles that will always be different sizes than the alleles at another locus. And therefore, you can do five loci with one color, another five with another color, another five with another color, another five with another color, meaning each primer you use that's specific for a locus would be fluorescing the same. But because the sizes of those alleles are different, you can look at them. So this is what you would see for an individual fingerprint on an automatic sequencing gel using fluorescence. And then when you isolate each of those five loci, that's what you get, 32 different alleles, 16 loci. I can assure you the probability of having that combination is practically zero. So that's what's done now for DNA testing in the law. I'm assuming later gene chips will be used. And then you'll have the allele of every loci of everybody who's arrested, or as you'll see, even suspected as a crime, because those of you that that voted for Proposition 69 in California last year, starting in 2009, anybody that's arrested for a felony, regardless of whether they're convicted or not, gives their DNA and goes into the database. Just arrested. Not convicted. Arrested. Of course, if you're not convicted, it's expunged after 2 years, but the burden of the proof, according to 69, is on you. It used to be on the court to say expunge it. Now you've got a petition to get it out of there. Good luck. now that it's sent to every single database in the United States, we'll see how it's going to get out of there. We'll talk about that. So let me spend a couple of minutes going back. We now have these very... Can I help you? You want to come in? Answer some questions?
I would love to.
You sure? Come on in. What's your name?
Danny.
You want to answer some questions in genetic engineering?
I'm definitely wrong.
Okay. So now let's go back. We have these DNA tests. Very powerful. In medicine, in individuality, disease alleles. What's the history? What's the history of DNA testing, gene testing in the United States, either directly or indirectly in this country? And we've talked a little bit about this, but in order to talk about the law, we have to go back and talk about history. And it's a pretty miserable history, as we've discussed several times in this class and elsewhere. The best book that's been written on DNA testing and eugenics by far, there is no better book, is by Dan Kevles, who used to be a professor in the history department here, but was grabbed away from Berkeley some time ago. And he is the world's expert on this subject called eugenics and the history of eugenics, particularly in relationship to the United States. And anybody who wants to understand how this was used in history and whatever should read this book, because it's an eye-opener. At the turn of the century, as you know, Mendel's laws of genetics were applied to man. And for very positive reasons, although they became very, very, very negative, people thought, well, we could use this thing called eugenics in order to remove from populations bad genes. And I was going to show you some clips, which I'll save for Thursday. Bad genes. We all know how that wound up. Those bad genes wound up killing many millions of people in Nazi Germany under the Nuremberg Act, because it went from simply sterilization to death sentence. And during that particular period of time, or I should say before, over 600,000 people were sterilized involuntarily in Germany, but then many millions were killed. However, the origins of all of that started in the United States of America. Of course, it didn't go that far, thank God. But the origins of the eugenics movement and sterilization laws started in the United States. So when you consider DNA and the law, its origin was here. Ironically, the origin was in Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory that's headed by James Watson, who discovered the structure of DNA. Because at the turn of the century, Davenport was the head of that laboratory, and he was the foremost eugenicist, geneticist in the United States. And many state legislatures, about 30 states, wound up passing laws that forcibly sterilized women and prevented them from having children involuntarily, because they were considered to be unfit, meaning genetically unfit, feeble-mindedness, etc., etc. Very, very, you know, arbitrary characteristics. And the most notorious of those cases was this one called Buck versus Bell, which we talked about, where the Supreme Court said because of the public welfare, they can justifiably sterilize an individual under the same promoting the general welfare as vaccination, meaning mandatory vaccinations. And as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, and we said, this is one of the most, there's been some horrible Supreme Court cases in United States history. Plessy versus Ferguson. Separate but equal is possible. That established the principle of racial segregation in public schools. Plessy versus Ferguson. Horrible. Korematsu versus the United States. It's permissible to intern Japanese Americans in concentration camps during World War II. That passed muster with the Supreme Court. And Buck versus Bell. It's possible to promote the general welfare, to sterilize individuals. Now, all of these things have been overturned. Brown versus the Board of Education, Korematsu was overturned. I could go into these Supreme Court cases. Buck versus Bell was overturned. But the point here is that there's precedent here. But it goes further than that in history. Because if you infer that a person's origins is due to their genotype, if you infer that Asian Americans have a certain genotype, which they do, and Southeastern Europeans have a certain genotype that they do, that goes beyond simply sterilization. It goes to the immigration laws of the United States of America. Because if you were Asian, you didn't get into this country in the 1920s. Or if you were from Poland or Hungary or from any of those countries, you didn't get into this country because of the quotas. But if you were from Great Britain or from France or from Denmark or from Norway, you got in. So in a sense, that immigration policy indirectly is a eugenics policy. And it's a policy based on, theoretically, your genotype. Because I can assure you that Asians have a slightly different genotype. It's obvious because we look different. They look different from someone such as myself. And so when we talk about DNA and the law, one must understand that there were laws, even though they didn't use DNA, they didn't understand ASOs, they didn't understand genotypes per se the way we do, that only, 70 years ago, when your grandparents or great-grandparents were alive, these laws were in place in this country, in the United States of America. And these are laws that, in my mind, deal with DNA. Because if you exclude someone on the basis of their origin or ethnic background, that's excluding their genotype. If you exclude someone and forcibly sterilize them because you consider them to be feeble-minded, even though you have absolutely no evidence of that, that's considered to be something which is based on DNA. And of course, all of you know, and I've said this before, I'm going to finish with a big surprise here. I always like to do that, as you know. The surprise wasn't the horror of the Holocaust and of the Nazis that did experiments on live people. And if any of you have never read William Shire's tremendous volumes on that period, if you want to read something that'll give you a real horror story, not like anything you see in the film, read it. You know how they tested for whether someone would last in the North Atlantic so that they can see how long it would take to rescue their flyers? They just took people from concentration camps and dipped them in cold water. And they actually did these experiments and published them in their journals at the time. So the point here is that we're dealing with things that are not that far removed from our own era. And hopefully we've learned a little bit from them. Or have we? In 1995, the People's Republic of China passed the People's Republic's eugenics law of 1995. And it's still in place. And what does it say? It says that everybody who wants to get married must undergo a premarital physical checkup that shall include the examination of the following diseases: genetic diseases of a serious nature, target infectious disease, and relevant mental diseases. What the hell does that mean? That sounds very much like Buck versus Bell to me. This is not then, this is now. What else does it go on to say? It says that physicians who perform the premarital physical checkup, as you can read, of individual female and male have been diagnosed with certain genetic diseases of a serious nature, as you can see, shall tell the couple to take appropriate measures, either to be sterilized, voluntarily though, or not to have any children. And it further goes on to say that an individual carrying a child that was deemed to have a mental defect or some genetic disease shall be advised to terminate the pregnancy of that little baby. This is now. So we're not just dealing with these kinds of laws that happened a long time ago. The difference is, to be fair to this Chinese law, it's voluntary. There's no penalty for not complying. That's a huge difference, of course. Huge difference. But the fact of the matter is that these laws still exist. This is a DNA law. This is a law based on someone's genotype. This is a law saying, you know, a certain genotype is better than a bad genotype. Of course, it's done for altruistic purposes because you know how horrible it is for someone to have to undergo and live even a short time with some of these horrible genetic diseases. Oh, and by the way, I must say, and I will phrase this in the term of editorializing here, that if you live in the state of South Dakota now, and if you have one of those fetuses that Dr. Evans showed you that had no brain or a large brain and you're a mother, you're going to have to carry that fetus to term because there's no way in the state of South Dakota anymore you can abort that fetus, even though it's dead, wouldn't be viable, and there's nothing you can do. How pleasant for that woman to know that from that ultrasound there's a child that she's bearing that's going to have no brain and not any chance to live, and she's got to carry that for 9 months. That was an editorial. I think you ought to read about that and think about it, but it deals with DNA. Because when you start talking about DNA testing, you start talking about reproductive issues, you start talking about choice issues, but you also talk about the rights of zygotes, you talk about the rights of embryos, you talk about the rights of children. It applies to everybody, of course. And as Carrie Mullis said in that little clip that I showed you a couple of weeks ago, we're ahead of the curve technologically because I don't think society has come to grips with all of this. And on Thursday, what you will see is, Sam, that there's a patchwork quilt state by state in dealing with these things, and you happen to live in one of the most liberal states. But in some states, the United States, there's no stem cell research permitted. There's no donating stem cells. There's no research on in vitro embryos. I mean, it's a hodgepodge. And so we'll be talking about that a little bit on Thursday. Okay. The surprise that I wanted to give you was the Chinese eugenics laws. Because if you read it, it comes awfully close with stuff that was written a long time ago. And that's the stuff that we have to concern ourselves with in dealing with the ability to use a DNA chip to analyze all of your genes at birth or before birth. How many of you have seen the film Gattaca? Well, if you haven't, rent it this weekend because that's what I call the Gattaca scenario. Okay, let me not let you go yet. Because I know you're sitting in these seats dying to know. Look at Charles, he's white as a ghost. I was very impressed with your take-home exams, we all were. I was very impressed with your performance on Thursday. I hope that that was a real measure of what you've learned. I don't know whether it is or not. All I can go by is the data, and the data was the performance on the take-home test and the performance on your oral for the take-home test, and I must say it was spectacular. The only thing that we were disappointed with, was the more than statistically significant answers that were exactly the same, including spelling errors. Now, I'm not going to take the time and put them on the board, but I had asked you not to do that. And that was the only thing. It wasn't that prevalent. But if you were in certain groups and did that, I would very, very much appreciate before the end of this week to come in and talk to me about it. Because I'd really like to know how that might have occurred. Very much so. No punitive, and I'm just curious. It educates me. In terms of how these things happen. But that was a very minor thing, but I had to bring it up. Mike and Gloria and Brandon and Toma were sitting there going, I can't believe this. How could they both misspell this word and put a period in exactly the same place and circle it in exactly the same place? And that's the kind of thing, am I right, Mike, that we were a little concerned about? Other than that, the highest score in the class was 384,000 points. I can identify who the individual is, but perhaps I shouldn't. But one individual had 384,000 points. The average on this test, not factoring in the bonus points, was 86%, which is pretty spectacular. That's out of 400,000. Now, when you factor in the bonus points, meaning you get rid of those 100,000 and you talk about, 50,000, and you only talk about the 400,000, the official graded average on this exam was 96%. It's pretty spectacular. I don't think any of you have anything to complain about. You did great, great job, seriously. A couple of you I know and that probably didn't do as well as you wanted to do, and I would hope that those of you who didn't do as well as you wanted to do, those few of you, will come in and talk to me so that we can see what we can do about it. I'm not going to go into how you did on each question. The question that you did the poorest on, in terms of a spectacular performance anyway, was the allele question. That is, calculating your allele frequency and understanding where VNTRs come from. And that was apparent from your oral exam, too. So they went hand in hand. Now, the DNA double helix essay, and I have to factor this in because it was new to you, and it was brand new in the class, and everything was new. And so I sort of take a little bit of that with a grain of salt because I think if you did it now, it'd be a little bit different story. But the average on that was 80%, which is still pretty good. And the surprising part of that was, where did the grades fall? Well, they fell surprisingly to me. I was just shocked on who was Wilkins and what did he do and who was Watson and Crick. In terms of answering what Watson and Crick's contribution was to the DNA double helix, it was very simple things like that. It wasn't anything really complicated or complex, but I think that probably really had more to do with just the newness in the class. On the other hand, you have so many bonus points this quarter that it's not going to hurt in any way. Because when everything is said and done, you go far beyond even your oral exam that you got 50,000 points for because you did spectacularly, almost takes into account all of that. And so I'm not worried about it, nor should you. The average on your quizzes is running about 102%, which is pretty spectacular too. Now, the key here is that with such high marks, and you have to answer this question, because I have no, I'm going to use the data, You come in 90% or higher, you're getting an A no matter what. That's my philosophy, and I'm happy to give it to you. But you have to answer, did I learn in direct proportion to what I got on these exams? And that's for you to answer and for you and your own conscience. I can only go on the data and say yes. And so all of us congratulate you on a fantastic job. I hope it translates again to next week on the final oral exam, and really just superb. And I just clap all of you for doing such a great job. And why don't we give a big round of applause for these people back here. Their butts off. I will say, though, that they got a little reward on Saturday night, because I took them all to Nobu's for dinner, and we had a huge feast that cost me a fortune, but it was well worth it. Are there any questions? The way we're going to do this is I want to do it as orderly as possible. We have Mike's discussion out here. Are you going to give them all out, or are you going to split them with Tomo, or what? Okay, so Tomo and Mike are going to give Mike's discussion out. Where is it going to be? And Jessica and Brandon are going to...